When the fashion industry decides to go retro, the latest look is invariably a modern take on an old style. That same thing is happening with food right now, specifically native foods. From Mexico to Canada, native communities are revitalizing traditional food knowledge. They're out in the forest, foraging for trout lilies and cattails. They're planting their heritage corn and participating in food ceremonies that have been dormant for years. And they're finding the simple act of teaching their native food traditions to the next generation holds immense healing power.
Just the look on my children's face when they've had a good harvest, and they know that they've actually contributed to our family's calories. That process is how that food becomes medicine.
I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, we talk about native food traditions. Later in the show, we learn how the marsh-dwelling muskrat was much more than just food for the Pamunkey Indians.
Every single part of the muskrat was used. The fur, the meat, the skulls, the bones, and then the brains were considered a delicacy.
But first, many tribal communities are reclaiming control of their food supply. They're growing traditional foods, plants, and medicines, and collaborating with the federal government to retain rights for hunting and gathering. This is also the season of the Ghost Supper. That's where tribes in the Great Lakes region honor ancestors and loved ones with traditional and favorite dishes. My guest, Lee Sprague of the Saginaw Chippewa Tribal College, teaches young people how to harvest and eat the foods that once sustained their tribal ancestors. Lee, this time of year, there are some special meals happening in your community called ghost suppers. What's a ghost supper?
Ghost suppers are a time when our communities gather together and we remember those who have passed on in the last year, but also in years past. And in our family, we actually will make foods that are the favorites of some of our relatives who are no longer here. You know, some of our relatives are great fishermen. Some of them were great hunters. Some of them are gatherers of different foods and medicines. And, you know, sometimes it was a bowl of beans and bacon or a piece of fry bread, which is our appropriation of other foods.
What do you remember most that you loved from ghost suppers?
I think the foods that I loved are the foods that my relatives ate. As a boy, I remember going house to house, making sure that we were going to eat wherever we sat. It's really impolite to go there and not eat something. So it's kind of a long day. but you know, it's important for the community. And what I do now with my children on ghost supper days, we make those favorite dishes of our relatives and we talk about them and really think about all the good things that person brought into our lives. There's a lot of emotion, a lot of sadness, and at the same time, there's a lot of joy because I'm getting to share with my grandchildren now what my father used to like.
When are the ghost suppers?
Traditionally, they're on November the 1st, the day after Halloween. And today, they happen all the way through November. There's a lot of ghost suppers. You know, some of them are going to happen on a Friday, then on a Saturday, then on a Sunday. Families just announced we're having our ghost supper on this day. And it's a time for me to connect up, you know, with my mother and my father and to share what they love with my children. You know, I look forward to it every year. And I hope that, you know, I hope that my grandchildren have a good knowledge of what I like to eat and what I used to do.
Do you gather foods for a ghost supper now in the traditional way, or have modern conveniences taken over?
I think many of us actually gather foods that we will use in part or in whole for our ghost suppers. You know, we harvest wild rice or manomin, and we make syrup, birch, and maple, candies. We have our gardens that we spent the summer in working. And, you know, on our travels and on our walks and as we go to the river, there's always something there that's good to taste, good to eat. And sometimes it's medicine, sometimes it's food. Sometimes they're the same thing, and it's difficult, but I always try and make sure that I have at least one calorie that I've gathered or that I've traded for or somebody's given me from their garden every day.
Tell me a little bit about the wild rice. Is that a traditional food, and how do you harvest, grow, and gather it?
Wild rice is at the heart of Anishinaabeg or Ottawa, Chippewa, Potawatomi ways. It's the reason we migrated to the Great Lakes from the East Coast. Our prophecies tell us that we were to live where the food grows on the water. And to this day, we still live where the food grows on the water. So we spend the winter talking about stories, how these things happen, our migration stories, our creation stories. In the springtime, we start gathering materials to use for baskets, to make tools. In the summer, we're often looking at wild rice lakes, making sure that they're coming in good and seeing if there's any issues or problems. And then in the fall time, you know, we do gather at the shore. There was probably 40 or 50 canoes in total on one lake in particular. And it's a time when families, multiple generations, come together to harvest manaomin. And we go out there in a really good way. We put down offerings. And we use two ricing sticks, or we call them knockers, or bawaiknatig in our language. And we reach over our canoes, or jimanak, and we bring in the wild rice over the canoe very gently. And with the other stick in our other hand, we tap the stick or very gently stroke the wild rice, and only the ripe grains will fall off into the canoe. When we release the plant, it stands up again. And we can come back in the same area maybe in a few days to gather some of the grains that are ripening up at that point. And to this day, we can still go there and really harvest a substantial amount of our calories for our good lives.
I love hearing you say we go wild ricing, like crabbing, right?
Yeah, it's an annual event, you know, and something that I was very fortunate to be exposed to as a young person. And then with my children and family, we're continuing to go to those lakes. And I teach my kids to know what birds are eating the wild rice at what time of the year. Swans and geese like it in the springtime. They like the green shoots before it comes to flower. Redwings and other blackbirds like to eat the seeds right before they're ready to harvest. The whole lake won't be in harvest at the same time. You have to really see and know where the rice is coming into harvest. And so when I'm out there with my children, you know, we teach them to look for the red-winged blackbirds, because I know that part of the lake is just about ready to harvest for us. Because I know those red wings like that wild rice in the milk state right before it becomes the seed or a hard seed. It's one of those things that really connects us to the immediacy of our environment. It makes all of us feel good. Just the look on my children's face when they've had a good harvest and they know that they've actually contributed to our family's calories and food, and that we're going to be eating that food. And just that process is how that food becomes medicine. It has all those good thoughts and wishes, the offerings of our people. It has all those good times and all those stories from this year and years past. And you see our stories coming alive out there in the water. You see the turtle, you see the muskrat, which is our creation story. And so these are very tangible things. There's not a lot of faith required. You know, we see our creation story in the water. We see our migration story just by harvesting the manoomin.
I'm trying to picture the wild rice. Is it filled with the little black, slender grains that we're all familiar with?
Generally, they can range anywhere from green or gray to dark gray. A lot of the black ones are actually commercial wild rice that has really taken over the marketplace. In 1970, for instance, our peoples in Anishinaabeg had 95% of the world's wild rice market. Now we have about 5%, and paddy rice, or commercially grown wild rice, has really taken over the marketplace and had a major impact on our economies.
You teach a course on food sovereignty at the Tribal Community College. What is food sovereignty?
Well, food sovereignty is our own abilities to provide for ourselves and our families from our own lands, and really, you know, not depend on a global food supply that, you know, oftentimes has many problems with it. We don't know where the food is coming from. We don't know the methods that are being employed to make that food. And so I believe that for all of us, you know, Indigenous peoples and all of us, it's important to start having control of our own food supply. When, you know, when I see my children plant blue corn in the springtime and see them starting to grow. And then when we harvest that blue corn plant, it's a beautiful thing, you know. And our children, you can see in their spirit how strong they feel that they've actually contributed to our whole family's well-being for our good lives. So my earliest memories along food sovereignty lines, and that wasn't a term I grew up with, but was of fishing with my family at Boot Lake. And on Fridays, having a big fish fry and eating bluegills, eating perch, eating sunfish. I used to get in trouble for fishing all day long, coming home after dark with my brothers, you know, but...
Now it's good.
My dad always wanted to know what we caught. He'd made sure that we cleaned them right. And that's one of those, you know, in terms of food sovereignty, this is critical. I remember as a kid, the first fish I caught, my dad made a big show of it. We came to the shore, we cooked that food up right away, and he thanked me for, you know, catching this fish and helping provide food for our families. My youngest son, Nimkeens, when he was maybe 5 years old, 4 or 5, and he had caught a fish. And I realized at that instant that I couldn't let my son eat that fish because of the mercury contamination. And it wasn't hard to distract him for just a few seconds to get him off of thinking that we were going to cook that fish right away. But for me, it was the realization that the very food the Creator put here before us, I could not feed to my young son. And this was maybe the first generation in the history of our peoples where the food the Creator gave to us could not be eaten by our children and our women. That, to me, is probably the biggest impact in terms of our traditional food ways. Fishing provided a lot of our calories. And now, maybe it's just old guys like me that can eat the fish.
One of the wonderful things that's happening are these food summits in the Great Lakes region. Tell me about those and how these are opportunities to share this knowledge.
Well, our tribe actually hosted the last food summit this summer, and we had people from across the continent, from South America to North America. A beaver was skinned, cleaned, stuffed with apples, pears, and other good fruits. We had a moose. There was an entire buffalo that was brought in, and we were shown how to butcher a buffalo. A sheep was butchered. We tapped birch trees, yellow birch trees, there on site. Birch is a good spring tonic. There was corn. There were corn dishes. We had halibut ceviche. Just this plethora of foods from across the continent by some of the top chefs in the United States, top native indigenous chefs.
Would you take people on forest walks to look for medicinal plants and food plants?
Yeah, and it was such a rich experience because we had, you know, elders and people that knew medicines and foods. A person would know this about this plant, and another person would know maybe a different use for it or a different medicinal use for it. There's a rich exchange of knowledge and information about what we're seeing. And then now there are new plants here. One of the plants that many native peoples here use, plantain, was brought over from Europe. It's not invasive in the sense that it plays well with other native plants, but it's a plant that we've learned has strong medicinal properties to it. And also, it tastes good in a salad. It's good for bee stings, good for pain medicine. Those are the things that we get to talk about and see and taste and understand when we're outside. Sometimes the word tradition can be a trap. You know, we've always been changing. We've always been adapting. But I think climate change has accelerated the change and the adaptation that we need to have. And it's a little bit daunting because things are not the same. You know, there are trees that I don't see anymore where I go. Probably 95% of the fish in the Great Lakes aren't native. We call the Department of Natural Resources the Department of Unnatural Resources. They brought the autumn olive tree in here for bird cover, and now that's an invasive and has covered large parts of good areas to harvest. But my elders have encouraged me to see what our birds are doing with these autumn olives. Are they eating them? And actually, that's what we did in the beginning. Every place that we went knew we had to observe, listen to stories from other peoples, to find out what was good to eat and how we could use it for our lives as a food or a medicine or both.
May I ask you if you have any tribal language phrases that you're comfortable speaking or that you regularly use?
Yeah, I mean, I can introduce ourselves in our language and who we are and our clans. And I just want to go ahead and say that so that at least you hear it. Mitigwabak Adishnikas, Ajijak and Dodam, Namanitigong Donjaba, Machi Banashiwich, and Dao. My name is Lee Sprague, or Wood That Bends But Doesn't Break. People say Hickory. I am from the Crane Clan. I am from the land under the big trees, which is Michigan. And I am from the Big Angry Bird tribe, or the Gun Lake tribe. And if anything, all of our children know how to say that, because the Creator needs to know that, who we are in our language.
Lee Sprague teaches at Saginaw Chippewa Tribal College. Coming up next, buying cars with muskrat money.